translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. The primeval Lord then assumed the tortoise incarnation in order to serve as a resting place, pivot, for the Mandara mountain, which was acting as a churning rod. The demigods and demons were churning the ocean of milk with the Mandara mountain in order to extract nectar. The mountain moved back and forth, scratching the back of Lord Tortoise, who, while partially sleeping, was experiencing an itching sensation. Purport. Although it is not in our experience, there is a milk ocean within this universe. Even the modern scientist accepts that there are hundreds and hundreds of thousands of planets hovering over our heads, and each of them has different kinds of climatic conditions. Srimad Bhagavatam gives much information which may not tally with our present experience. But as far as Indian sages are concerned, knowledge is received from the Vedic literatures, and the authorities accept without any hesitation that we should look through the pages of authentic books of knowledge, Shastra Chakshurvat. So we cannot deny the existence of the ocean of milk as stated in the Srimad Bhagavatam, unless and until we have experimentally seen all the planets hovering in space. Since such an experiment is not possible, naturally we have to accept the statement of Srimad Bhagavatam as it is, because it is so accepted by spiritual leaders like Sridhar Swami, Jiva Goswami, Vishwanath Chakravarti, and others. The Vedic process is to follow in the footsteps of great authorities, and that is the only process for knowing that which is beyond our imagination. The primeval Lord, being all-powerful, can do whatever he likes, and therefore his assuming the incarnation of a tortoise or a fish for serving a particular purpose is not at all astonishing. Therefore, we should not have any hesitation whatsoever in accepting the statements of the authentic scriptures like Srimad Bhagavatam. The gigantic work of churning the milk ocean by the combined effort of the demigods and the demons required a gigantic resting ground or pivot for the gigantic Mandara hill. Thus, to help the attempt of the demigods, the primeval Lord assumed the incarnation of a giant tortoise swimming in the ocean of milk. At the same time, the mountain scratched his backbone as he was partially sleeping and thus relieved his itching sensation. Read the verse again. Kshiro dadava madadana vayutapanam unmatnatama mritalabdhaya adidevaha prishte nakacha pavapur vidhara gotram nitrakshano driparivata kashana kandahu. The primeval Lord then assumed the tortoise incarnation in order to serve as a resting place pivot for the Mandara mountain, which was acting as a churning rod. The demigods and demons were churning the ocean of milk with the Mandara mountain in order to extract nectar. The mountain moved back and forth, scratching the back of Lord Tortoise, who, while partially sleeping, was experiencing an itching sensation. Om Gyanatmirandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshuramilitam Jaina Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadha Srivasadi Gaura Bhaktavinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama 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 Hare Hare. So here we are hearing about the pastimes of Kormadev, the Lord's tortoise incarnation. And we will speak about the pastime. You could say of which Kormadev's appearance is a part, or actually it's all based around Krishna's pastimes, but there's lots of different things that happen during the pastime of churning the milk ocean, and one of the parts of it is that Korma is there assisting the demigods, helping them to achieve what they needed to achieve. By the way, I beg for the mercy and the blessings of the devotees here, especially the senior devotees, Yadu Bahuru. Hope I can say something to serve the Vaishnavas. But as well as speaking about this pastime, Srila Prabhupada makes a very important point in the purport. Actually, most of the purport is about this fact that this can seem difficult to understand. At the moment, we have Beer Monk Challenge. We have some new chaps here for a week taking part in Krishna Consciousness. They're not here for the class today because they have a separate class. But just stepping into a temple such as this, seeing the pictures that are here, seeing the altar, seeing how we're dressed, it can all be a culture shock. I remember I went to India when I was 18 for 9 months, and I didn't really have culture shock when I went there, but when I came back to England after being in India for 9 months, I had a culture shock that all the cars were driving on the same side of the road, and you could go into a building and it was like clean and air conditioned and lit properly and everything was organized. It was like I was used to the chaos of India, the attractive, wonderful chaos of India, but the chaos over there. So when we're hearing here about a gigantic tortoise who is asleep, half asleep, and the demigods and the demons are scratching his back with a mountain and churning an ocean of milk, and various things are emanating from that ocean of milk, then it can be a lot to digest. For us devotees, we're kind of used to it. We've heard this pastime before, and actually this pastime is very famous. I heard once Kavi Chandra Maharaj was giving a class, and he was saying that, probably Sridhar would know better, that in Thailand, in the airport there in Bangkok, there's a huge, not mural, but like a sculpture of this pastime. I'm sure in Bali it's even more prevalent, the Vedic culture, but even in Thailand I think they have a big, like, kind of demonstration of this pastime. So it's very well known. I'm sure many Hindus would know of this pastime as well. But for the average Joe, especially here in England, to hear about these things is a bit mind-blowing. I've been listening to and reading Brihat Bhagavatamrita, and that's also extremely mind-blowing how Narada Muni is traveling all over the universe, out of the universe, back in the universe, meeting so many different incarnations of the Lord, and then Gopal Kumar is doing the same thing, meeting different incarnations of the Lord that we don't even generally hear about in Krishna Consciousness and Srila Prabhupada's books. So it can be very mind-blowing. And if we don't have strong faith, then we can think, this is a little bit weird, this is a little bit unbelievable, this is a little bit too much. One time my father and my stepmother came to the temple in central London when I was a brahmachari there. And my stepmother, he's a bit more favorable than my dad. She was looking around and she was okay with everything. And then she saw the picture of Lord Nrsingadev with gunded with intestines, blood everywhere on the floor. She said, yeah, I like everything, but, you know, I'm not so sure about that. So sometimes we have our limits. And when it comes to Krishna exhibiting his personal forms and certain unusual pastimes, then it can be difficult. But Srila Prabhupada says here in the purport that how do we know that it isn't true? And he's talking specifically about the ocean of milk. He's saying, how do we know that there isn't an ocean of milk? Can you prove to us that there isn't an ocean of milk and that these pastimes didn't happen? Where is the evidence that is the case? And Srila Prabhupada is making the point that we have to hear from authorities. So probably most of the devotees here know about these aspects of epistemology. Epistemology means the science of knowing something. So we're all experiencing the world day in and day out, but how do we know that what we're experiencing is an actual fact? How do we know that we're not just dreaming right now, or we're not just plugged into some computer game, and this is all some kind of virtual reality, and like in the Matrix, we're some body lying down somewhere and we're plugged in, and this is just some advanced computer game? How do you know? How do we know? Can you prove it? No, we're just kind of here, plonked in the middle of the situation, accepting it as it is. I remember one time when I was really young, I don't know how old, maybe about Madhusham's age, and I was at home, and there was some kind of party going on, and there was a lot of people there, and I was sitting there, and I was just looking at all these people, and I was thinking, what if I'm just imagining all of this? What if it's not actually real, and it's just like I'm just imagining it, and they're not really there? And I started to get a little bit freaked out. And I said, and my mom came in and said, "Are you okay? What's up?" And I said, "Mom, what if these people aren't here? Maybe, and I'm just imagining it. How do I know that they're actually there and, you know, everything is real?" And she said an interesting thing that kind of snapped me out of it, was that it's okay. Everybody thinks like that sometimes. Okay, that's normal to think like that. So, but it's not an answer. Just because everybody may think like that sometimes and you know, contemplate that, it's not an answer to, you know, is this world real or is it not? So it's also something that can't really ever be proved to the nth degree. And actually nothing can really be proved to the nth degree. How can we know something 100% that this is actually real? It's a fact. There's always that possibility that, you know, it could be something else. There could be another reality that I'm not aware of at the moment. But epistemology is talking about what is the best way that we can understand the reality around us? And there are three main ways that we can do that. Do the devotees know those three main sources of knowledge that we can, through which we can acquire experience of the world around us? Shabda, yeah? Anuman, yep. Not Hanuman, Anuman. Pratyaksha, yeah. So what's Shabda? You're the representative of Shabda now, Smada Harifu. Hearing, yep. What's Anuman? Mental reasoning, yep. And Pratyaksha? Direct sense perception, yeah. So Pratyaksha is generally how people experience the world. We see things, we hear things, we touch things, we experience life around us every day. It works, you know. I know pretty much that this stand is here because I can touch it, I can feel it. Anuman is inference, understanding that, like extrapolating knowledge. So one of the examples that is given is that if I see somewhere that there's smoke, like we often see there's smoke in the burning area over there, then you don't need to walk up and look and see if there's a fire, because there's not going to be smoke unless there's a fire or unless there has been a fire. So just by seeing the smoke, then you can understand that there's been fire. And then Shabda is sound vibration, hearing from knowledge. So Anuman and Pratyaksha are imperfect. Actually, Shabda can be imperfect as well, because we can misunderstand things. Like, I'm a little bit colorblind, which wasn't very helpful when I was a pujari in Hungary, but I struggled through choosing the outfits at like 3 o'clock in the morning and trying to figure out which jewelry goes with it when you're a bit colorblind. So what I perceive as a color is not perfect. So what I may say is, I mean, it's not really bad, but when it gets to shades of colors like purple and lilac and blue and different shades of red and green, then it's a bit confusing for me. So my senses are imperfect. All of our senses are imperfect. Like, dogs can hear sound vibrations that we can't hear. There's certain whistles that you use for dogs, and it's a sound, but we don't hear it. We don't have the capacity to hear that. So Pratyaksha is pretty imperfect, but Shabda can be perfect, depending upon what your source of Shabda is. So this is the general way that we acquire knowledge in education circles. We hear from teachers, they convey information to us, they describe it to us. If education was based around Pratyaksha, it would take a really long time. If you're in a geography class and the teacher said, "Okay, we're going to learn about Africa today, so we're all going to get on a plane, we're going to go to Africa, we're going to walk around, we're going to find out how big it is, how many people live there, what rivers there are, what natural resources there are." I mean, that would be a long geography class. So all of that information over hundreds of years or tens of years is all condensed and just explained to you. So you don't have to go through all of that. So Shabda is very potent in that sense and very effective. But it also depends on who you're listening to, right? We've all been misled by so many people in our lives. We've all been given such different types of information by different people and taken in different directions. So we have to have Shabda from a perfect source. And if we hear that Shabda from a perfect source, then we're good, then we're cool, then we know what the reality is. Just like in this pastime, Srila Prabhupada It's explaining that, yeah, we can understand that there's a gigantic tortoise, there's an ocean of milk, there are demigods and demons, and we can understand all the details of that because it's coming from a perfect source. And that is our main process in Krishna consciousness, hearing from a perfect source. This knowledge that is descending from the Guru Parampara, from ultimately from Krishna through our different spiritual masters is called Avaroha Panta. Avaroha because it's descending like avatar, it comes down. And the other empirical system of gathering up as much knowledge as you can and like having a bunch of knowledge and drawing conclusions from that is called Aroha Panta, which means ascending knowledge. So you're like gathering it up and trying to get as much data as you can and then drawing conclusions from that. Mother Omalu was saying in one class a long time ago that with science, so-called science, today's science, then you cannot even claim to have a conclusion on what is the world, what is the goal of life, and decisive topics like this, because of the very nature of science, that you're gathering a bit of knowledge through your senses and microscopes and telescopes or computers. And then what you're saying is, according to the information we have, this is the conclusion. But it's not an absolute statement, because they don't know. Like Srila Prabhupada says, how do we know that there's not an ocean of milk if we haven't visited every single planet in this universe? So all scientists can say that, as far as we know, this conclusion isn't wrong. But they can't say, this is the fact, this is a fact. There's gravity everywhere. Human beings, you know, always look like this. They can't say that because they don't know. That we have an extremely limited perception of reality. So all you can say is like, I mean, how many countries have I gone to, for instance? A few have been to Europe, India, America. I know I've been to Africa or Spain or China or Japan. So I don't know what it's like over there. I've got no idea. I can only say what I've experienced, and that's what the scientists can do as well. But what we experience is so minute, right? Usually they're saying that life only exists on this planet. So it's such a fallacy, it's such a mistake to say that. What we're experiencing on this planet is such a tiny aspect of reality. There was one devotee, I can't remember his name, or Satyasutapu in Hungary. He's very intelligent, he's into cosmology, and he was saying that, I might forget the exact figures, but if you had a diagram of the universe according to the Vedic conception, that in a portion of the universe which we're all inhabiting, that 4 billion miles in diameter, if that was a millimeter, then if you factor in the different coverings of the universe as well, that would be like, I think it's 1 kilometer from the center of the universe to the end of the outer covering. So the whole universe that's populated with all of the 14 planetary systems is so tiny just compared to the coverings of the universe. And that's just one universe. And the material universes are explained to be 1/4 of the creation of God, 3/4 being the spiritual creation. So scientists defining reality on the basis of what they're experiencing on this planet with their instruments is totally inaccurate. And that would be okay if they said that, if they conveyed that, but they don't. They say that this is the reality, this is the truth, there was a big bang, there is evolution, you know, the world, the universe is expanding, and they just present themselves as an authority. And the general mass of people just accept, like I just accepted when I went to school, I didn't even think that there wasn't a big bang or there wasn't evolution. It's just in the schools, which are presented as authorities, they just convey that. That's what they teach you as a child, right? This is the reality. But when we realize that this doesn't work in our life, and this doesn't work in society in general, life based upon these atheistic conclusions, then if someone's intelligent, they'll think about this can't be right, there must be something else. So we're very lucky that we've come to Krishna consciousness and we're actually coming in contact with the reality. And in the beginning, if it is difficult for us to take certain things on board, we should at least have an open mind and give the philosophy of Krishna consciousness the benefit of the doubt. Okay, so we spoke a little bit about that, about epistemology and about accepting knowledge, even if it does seem unusual, because this is what Srila Prabhupada is spending most of his time talking about in the purport. I thought now we could also speak a little bit about the pastime in which korma appears. So at one point, this is all explained in the 8th canto of the Bhagavatam, that the demigods had offended their spiritual master. Was it the spiritual master or was it Durvasa Muni? Maybe some of you know in this particular instance. I think it was Durvasa Muni. Durvasa Muni had come and he gave a garland to Indra. And Indra, being intoxicated by his wealth and his power, didn't accept it in an appropriate way, and he gave it to his elephant, Airavata. And Airavata just kind of dropped it on the floor and trampled over it. And due to that offense of not treating Durvasa Muni correctly, the demigods lost, I think actually Durvasa Muni cursed them, the demigods lost a lot of power, and the demons, who were always ready to fight the demigods and challenge them, they overpowered the demigods. So the demigods were in a difficult situation, and they approached the Supreme Lord, and he said to them that what you should do is you should go to the milk ocean, which is where Kshuradakshaya Vishnu resides in this material world, and you should churn the milk ocean. This will help you. So we can see right from the outset of this pastime that there's so many different lessons to learn from it. One lesson is that the demigods are always, they're devotees. They're on the side of, they're devoted to Krishna. They may have material desires. They're Sakama Bhaktis usually, although not all of them. Like Yamaraj is a pure devotee. Who else is a pure devotee amongst the demigods? Shiva is a pure devotee. So it depends. Brahma can be a pure devotee. But in general, the demigods are Sakama Bhaktas. So they worship Krishna, but they also have material desires. But their power is also limited. Like when Gopal Kumar is traveling to different places throughout the universe, then he goes to see Indra. And then when he's with Indra, I think it's the sages from Mahaloka. The sages from Mahaloka come, and all of the inhabitants of Indraloka, they're paying obeisances and they're so respectful to the sages who have come from Mahaloka. And Gopal Kumar realizes that the inhabitants of Mahaloka are in a higher position than the inhabitants of Indraloka, and then he wants to go to Mahaloka. From there, he sees that the inhabitants of Janaloka are even more advanced. Shishi Radhika Kulananda Ki Jai. And from there, he goes to Brahmaloka. So the powerful demigods, they're also in anxiety, they're also struggling with various situations, and they're also totally dependent upon Krishna. So when the demigods get in trouble, they turn to Krishna. And they get in trouble when they don't actually follow the correct Vaishnava etiquette or the correct Vedic culture. They didn't respect this great sage, Durvasa Muni, so they lost a lot of power and they had to turn to the Supreme Lord. So the Lord told the demigods, you should go to the milk ocean and you should churn the milk ocean and your problems will be resolved. But just as in our life, that wasn't an easy task. The demigods, they had to go to Mandara Mountain and get Mandara Mountain and take it to the milk ocean. And although they were such powerful demigods, they struggled really hard to take Mandara Mountain to the ocean of milk. And they were getting injured doing this, and some of them died as well. Some of the demigods died and some of the demons. And it wasn't until they again requested the help of Lord Krishna, and Krishna came and just picked up the mountain on the back of Garuda and flew over to the milk ocean and put it down there, that they were successful. And then Krishna told them that you should get Vasuki to come. He's going to be the rope that you're going to use to churn the ocean of milk with Mandra Mountain as the churning rod. So they got Vasuki. They brought Vasuki. He's the greatest of the serpents. He's the biggest serpent. And they wrapped Vasuki around Mandra Mountain, which I'm assuming was upside down. Otherwise, was it upside down, Mandra Mountain? Was it like that? I have to see. But anyway, they wrapped him around Mandra Mountain. And but you can't churn if you haven't got something to churn on. You can't just do it. And actually, they started to do it, and Mandra Mountain would just sink into the milk ocean. So they again prayed to Krishna. You can see that through this pastime, nothing would have happened without Krishna's intervention in various different ways. And so then Krishna came in this form of Kormadev, acting as the pivot for the demigods and the demons so that they could churn the milk ocean. But he did have an ulterior motive, Korma, because he had an itch on his back. So while he was acting as a pivot, he was half asleep, he was quite relaxed while this whole thing was going on. And this Mandra Mountain, when the demigods and the demons were churning the milk ocean with Vasuki, then it was scratching. He was scratching his back. So he was multitasking. So Kormadev was there. The demigods and the demons were trying to churn the milk ocean. And we can see through this pastime also the different mentality of the demons and the demigods. That when the demons came, everybody was a little bit reluctant to churn using Vasuki because he's a snake. He's a bit dangerous. Snakes are not usually that trustworthy. But the demons, they wanted to churn using the head of Vasuki because they thought it was a bit more high class. They didn't want to go near the bottom end of Vasuki. They thought, you know, that's just like, I don't know, if snakes like have a bottom, but like their feet or like the bottom part of him is more unclean. So they thought, we'll take the head of Vasuki and we'll churn from this side. And the demigods, I think, of course, Krishna said to them as well, I said, it's okay, don't worry, you take the end, the tail of Vasuki. But that backfired on the demons because when they held the head of Vasuki, because he was, some of these serpents, they breathe fire and there's smoke and things like that coming out, so they would get burned and filled with smoke and singed by the smoke and the fire coming from the mouth of Vasuki, so that didn't work very well from them. Similar to when Duryodhan and Arjuna went to Krishna before the battle of Kurukshetra. Similar mood, that Arjuna approached the feet of Krishna in a humble way and Duryodhan approached the head of Krishna thinking that when he wakes up he'll see me first. But when Krishna woke up, then he looked down to where Arjuna was, and Arjuna got to ask first for what benedictions he wanted before the battle of Kurukshetra. So they were churning the milk ocean in this way. And does anybody know what the first thing that happened was when they were churning the milk ocean? Well, it's not the first thing because lots of things have already happened, but what was the next thing that happened? Yeah, poison came out. So we may also experience that in our lives, that when you begin something, some kind of endeavor, Dayananda Maharaj was saying to me the other day, when you try to do something good in this world, then you're faced with so many obstacles. Prabhupada also said that if you just try and do something good, not even a big thing, but it's just you're just faced with obstacles all the way, in the beginning especially. That is the mode of goodness, that it is poison in the beginning and nectar in the end. So the demigods are there, it's the ocean of milk, it's the residence of Kshiradakshaya Vishnu. It's not just some, you know, rubbishy salt ocean that we've got, it's an ocean of milk. Can you imagine? I can't imagine what it's like. Is it all clean when they have these oceans, like ocean of sweet water or the ocean of yogurt? Or is it like, you know, you wouldn't want to in general, drink our water in our oceans? Is it all clean on these higher planets? I guess it depends on where it is. Can you drink that yogurt or that milk? Anyway, they're churning the ocean of milk and the poison comes out. And there's such a huge amount of poison that it's threatening to destroy the whole universe. So the demigods also don't know what to do in this situation. And ultimately they turn to Lord Shiva. So we can see how powerful Lord Shiva is in comparison to the rest of the demigods there. Afraid that the whole universe is going to become destroyed. And what does Lord Shiva do? He drinks it. Then not only does he just counteract it or, you know, put it somewhere or like get a landfill site or send it to some third world country, which I think is generally what happens with the recycling in England. It's just kind of sent to Nicaragua or somewhere and dumped over there. He drinks it. And there's a very famous verse in the 8th canto which explains that this is the mentality of devotees, that they will take on suffering, they will take on difficulties for the welfare of everybody else. And that famous verse is Tapyante Lokata Pena Sadhava Praya Shojanaha Paramaradanam Taddi Purushashyakilatmanaha. It is said that great personalities almost always accept voluntary suffering because of the suffering of people in general. This is considered the highest method of worshipping the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is present in everyone's heart. Paramaradanam taddi. The highest method of worshipping the Supreme Lord is to accept voluntary suffering on behalf of people in general. So Lord Shiva embodies that teaching, and this is a perfect example of that. So he consumed the poison, and then after that it got better. They continued churning the milk ocean. Lots of wonderful things emerged. Airavata came, although I already said that Indra was sitting on Airavata, but we understand that sometimes there are these pastimes where something manifests, like this pastime of how Govardhan Hill manifests, or there's other pastimes of how Radhakund manifests, but we understand that they're actually there eternally, but still they have a pastime of how they manifest in different ways. Also Uchaishrava appeared, and it says that Bali Maharaj took Uchaishrava, which is like a celestial horse. Lakshmi Devi also appeared, and she came and she went to reside with Vishnu. But the demons were quite disappointed when Lakshmi came, and then she was looking around, I believe, with a garland, seeing who's an appropriate partner for me. And she couldn't see anybody until she saw Vishnu, and then she went to Vishnu. This is my eternal consort. And the demons were a little bit like, you know, we missed out there. Shame we couldn't have had Lakshmi for our own. But then Varuni Devi manifested from the ocean of milk, who is the goddess of intoxication. And the demons were very happy to accept her. Interesting how these different personalities are personified. And then Dhanvantari manifested from the ocean of milk, and he was there present with the nectar, so he was carrying the nectar. And what happened then? The demons immediately went forward and they stole the nectar off Dhanvantari and they took it away somewhere else. So at that point also the demigods went to Krishna and they were like, you know, we're stuck again for like the 10th time in this pastime. We need your help, can you help us? And so what Krishna did was he manifested in a female form called Mohini. So when Krishna manifested in this form, he was so beautiful, he was so alluring, that he went to the demons, and typical of the demons, they had the nectar, they had what they were looking for, the demigods wanted it as well, the demons had it, but the demons were quarreling with themselves over the nectar. They couldn't deal with it in an appropriate way, in an adult way, they were fighting over it. So Mohini came and she pacified them and said, look, I can see that you're fighting over the nectar. And this was just the demons fighting over it. So you sit down And if you'll accept my decision as regards, you know, who should have the nectar, then I'll deal with it. And the demons were so bewildered by the beauty of Mohini Devi that they couldn't, they were just, they weren't really, they were intoxicated by her beauty. And she said that, I think she even said that even if I do something that's inappropriate or not fair, then I would still want you to accept that because I want you to accept that. Is that okay? And they were like, yeah, yeah. Whatever you like, we don't mind. You just do it. So then actually what she did is she sat down the demigods and the demons, and she just started feeding the nectar to the demigods. She didn't give any to the demons. And Rahu at that time, he saw that this is, you know, she's cheating us actually. Rahu was a little bit conscious of that. He saw that she's cheating us. She's just giving all the nectar to the demigods. So he sat down between the sun and the moon, and Mohini Devi was going down feeding the demigods one by one the nectar. And she fed Rahu a little bit of it because he was disguised as a demigod. And then they realized that Rahu was not a demigod, he was a demon. And I think it was Mohini Devi who chopped off his head with the Sudarshan Chakra. Is that right, Madhi? Okay. But he'd already drank some of the nectar, so he became immortal to some degree. So when she chopped his head off, then that head, if, you know, if somebody, I was thinking that the Be a Monk Challenge members would be here today. So there's definitely a lot of far out aspects to this pastime. So she chopped his head off, and that head became a planet, which now we're still dealing with, probably many of us in our astrological charts from time to time. And then she just fed the demigods. And after that, Krishna left, after feeding the demigods nectar. But actually, after that, it still carried on. The demigods were much more powerful after they had the nectar, but the demons began to fight with the demigods again, and it just carries on. But that is the main focus of the pastime, of the churning of the milk ocean. So we can see that there are many aspects to that pastime, unlimited aspects to that pastime, that we can apply in our lives, and I mentioned many of them. I won't go through them again. Respecting authority, depending on Krishna, you know, acting like a demigod, not like a demon. Many different things, but these are things that we need to apply in our life now, in our situation. And although we're going through different incarnations of the Lord in this chapter, and we're dealing with Korma Dev in this verse, actually, our Ishtadevas are Lord Chaitanya and Lord Krishna. So we can understand that just as this pastime went on, it was like the Leela of Mohini Devi, it was the Leela of Korma Dev, it was the Leela of Dhanvantri, who is a partial expansion, then what is happening now is the Leela of Lord Chaitanya. So devotees are taking part in this movement, going out on Harinam, dancing in front of the deities, distributing prasadam, trying to understand Krishna's pastimes. This is all the pastimes of Lord Chaitanya. So if we are also trying to take part in that, applying these different principles that we learn from these pastimes of Srimad Bhagavatam, then that is appropriate for us. We shouldn't forget that our Ishtadevas are Lord Chaitanya and Lord Krishna. Sometimes devotees get into worshipping Lord Narsingadev, but that's not our goal. In extremely rare circumstances it may be, but in 99% of cases it's not. Our goal is to go back to Goloka Vrindavan. And a part of Goloka Vrindavan is also Shweta Dweep, the abode of Lord Chaitanya. That is what Lord Chaitanya and Lord Krishna came to give. And we should have faith that if we are serving in Lord Chaitanya's mission, then we will achieve our goal. And then we can see in this pastime that Krishna always helps the devas, the demigods, the devotees. He always helps them at every step. Even though they're facing great difficulties, some of them died carrying the mountain. The whole universe was threatened to be destroyed by the poison. The demons were more powerful than the demigods. They were destroying the demigods in the beginning. Even though the demigods were facing these like mortal challenges, Krishna helped them through every step. It was exciting. There was adventure. There was risk. But we should also think that actually in our situation as well, right now there's a fight going on between the demigods and the demons in this world. Right? We're going out. You're going out and Harry and I'm on Saturday night in Leicester Square. What's there? Sex shops, kebab shops. Everyone's drinking alcohol. What more do you want? What more sinful activities could you have? Everything like one next to another in Leicester Square. Everything is there. So this fight is going on between the demigods and the demons within Lord Chaitanya's pastimes. And we should have faith that if we just push on, if we carry on and we're dependent upon Krishna, then he will, yogakshemam vahamyaham, he will carry what we lack and he'll preserve what we have. And just like in that pastime with Arjuna Acharya, he thought, vahamyaham, that's a little bit too much. The Krishna personally will come and he will solve my problems. No, he will do that through an agent. But that whole pastime of Arjuna Acharya, which I didn't have time to say right now, shows that no, it's Krishna. Krishna knows exactly where we're at. Krishna knows exactly what is happening with you in every second. And Krishna wants us to achieve success. So if we follow in the footsteps of the demigods of being faithful and depending on Krishna, then we will also achieve the ultimate goal, just as the demigods were successful in this pastime. Okay, thank you very much for your attention and your tolerance. Please forgive any offenses and mistakes, of which I'm full. We have to finish there, because I have to take Madhushan to Gurukul. Thank you, Madhu, for being so tolerant. You just sat there through the whole class, didn't even say a word. Thank you very much. Grantara Shrima Bhagavatam ki jai. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Shri Shri Radha Gokula Nanda ki jai.